Hello, everybody. I'm Shannon Oki. I'm from a company called Cooperative Press in Cleveland, Ohio. And we publish essentially knitting books and craft business books. So that's our particular niche for the purposes of today's conversation. I want to ask, though, before we get started, how many of you are actually knitters? Okay, more than I expected. That's good. So for the rest of you, we'll explain what the title. There's a double entendre here in the title. A long tail is a certain type of knitting cast on. So you have the long tail like that, and then you have the long tail of book selling, a la Chris Anderson from Wired Magazine. So we're going to be talking about sort of both things today. And so for our purposes, niche publishing is going to be any publishing that you couldn't maybe consider commercialable on, the sort of thing that Random House is going to pick up, the sort of thing that, you know, a big publisher is going to give you a big advance for. And that doesn't necessarily mean that all topics that a Random House wouldn't pick up are niche, but for our purposes, let's call it specialty publishing, or maybe something that's got such a narrow focus that a big publisher wouldn't want to pick it up. Because publishers, as a rule, tend to be interested in going lowest common denominator, picking up whatever thing they think is going to sell the most, not necessarily something that has an audience. And I think that, you know, looking at the panels here at South By, you can see that there's an audience for almost everything. It's finding that audience. So we're going to talk about finding your audience, what you do with them when you get them, and how you can take the content that you have locked up in you and turn that around and publish it somehow, whether it's an ebook, whether it's a print-on-demand book. We'll leave time for questions at the end, or if you want to ask a question while we're in the middle of something, feel free. But the market may not have caught up to you yet, and I think that's what we see a lot of. Publishers tend to buy the same things all at the same time. So if they pick up a book on topic X and then they find out, oh, our competitors just bought topic X also, then they'll start redoubling their efforts and buying all of the same things. So what ends up happening is that all of those books hit the market at the same time, and you know, the general public says, well, we don't really need four books on topic X. So in a way, they're their own worst enemies, whereas we can take charge and jump in right at the right time, get it on the market faster, and scoop that audience before the big publishers even have time to turn around a contract. And I think that's another thing that we need to think about when we're talking about the benefits of niche publishing versus going with a major. You've got that fast turnaround time, and you also end up making more money. So we're going to talk numbers, which not many people do. The publisher math, this is an example of an actual project. It was with Random House, I'll tell you that. They offered $15,000 to my co-author and I, and taking out a percentage for our agent, they required that we pay the photographer out of our own advance. So the photographer that they specifically told us we had to use wanted $7,000. There goes $7,000. We would have needed another four to pay for some of the other things that had to be done, and, you know, 500 slush fund for things like shipping, things like that. So you divvy that up, and we're down to how much for a year of work? Would you work for a year for $1,000? I don't think so. And the final straw, because, again, it's a coup to be published by a big house. At least a lot of people think so. I might have done it, but for one thing. And that was their complete resistance to digital technology. Random House has been slow in coming up to the digital technology. Ravelry, which is, I guess, the closest equivalent is like a Facebook for knitters. They just added on their 2 millionth member, and these are members all over the world. We had, for this particular project, said, could we post the projects up as single pattern downloads on Ravelry? Essentially creating 15 separate single-page ads for the book. Now, most people, they're not going to just buy a single pattern if they like more than one pattern in the book. They're going to just go buy the book. So in essence, we're feeding them traffic and we're feeding them sales. And what did Random House say? No, we can't do that. And I said, well, why can't we do that? I'll put them up. You don't have to do it. And they said, but we can't do that. Okay, but why can't you do that? Well, we don't do that. Have you ever done it before? No, we can't do that. And I just finally said, look, I'm not doing a year of work for $1,200 and the complete inability to promote my own work on a place that has concentrated a million plus at that point users in one location. So again, had we taken this book and put it directly up on Ravelry and started selling it, we would have made more money immediately, I can tell you, than we would have made for a whole year of work doing the book to their specification and doing a book that we didn't necessarily want to do. So this is, again, why you may be better off actually doing it yourself. And just for, I know a lot of people are interested in fiction, so I'll give you some numbers from the fiction side of things. My friend Rachel, who writes fiction with knitting component in it, her book went to auction and she got $110,000, which sounds great until you calculate what's left after the tax, what's left after her agent, and then you divvy it up into 9 equal payments because publishers don't pay you that whole chunk up at once. So she makes about $18,000 a year and she's expected to crank out 3 reasonably good books. That's before she even gets to go to any writing conferences, before she pays for anything like that out of pocket. She still has to work 80 hours a week. So what ends up happening with something like that in the fiction world, you've got a little bit less on the production side of things. She ended up taking some scraps she had left over from one of her novels and asked if the publisher wanted to do anything with them, and they said no. So she put them up as a Kindle single and immediately netted several hundred dollars, which it was a good thing for her, not just from a money perspective, but because the Kindle single introduced people to her fiction world, introduced people to her characters. Now they have an incentive to go out and buy the other books. So there's a lot of things that we have the flexibility to do if we'll only just step up and do it. And if you're in a position and you know what the market is and what the thing is, if somebody comes waving a book advance in your face, you can sort of look at the math, I think, a little better now and say, okay, maybe this isn't the right deal. 10% royalty, in essence, translates to 5% royalty because most contracts now have a clause in it that says if we sell to a discounter of any kind for 52% off the cover price or more, and read Amazon or anybody like it, you get half your royalty, not your full royalty. So now every book that sells through Amazon, you're only getting 5% of that cover price. The publisher math doesn't add up a lot of the time. Romance novels, which are probably one of the more lucrative, you know, things out there, believe it or not, they're one of the only, I think, genres I've ever seen that specifically have a list of the actual numbers, what publishers are paying in that field, and what people are actually netting by the time they do the work. So from just a point of interest, this is a really neat link to take a look at, even if you have no interest in writing a Harlequin novel whatsoever, just to see what the numbers are. I see people are taking pictures. Can I go forward, or you've got it? Okay. I look for the devices to go down. All right, so again, the long tail, we're talking this one, not this one. How many of you actually read the book, The Long Tail? Yeah. So you know the some of his figures in here, how the average BNN carries 130,000 titles, and yet more than half of the sales on Amazon come from that larger, wider, broader range of things. He's broken it down into 3 rules of making everything available, lowering the prices, and then helping the consumers find it. But before you can do that, you actually have to have something to make available, so let's talk about content for a second. Now, I do a lot of work with authors who are coming to me with an idea for a book, and they maybe haven't thought it through all the way yet. So what you really need to do is take a look at what's already out there. Because again, if the publishers have already gone on a spree of doing books on topic X, there's already going to be a glut of things out there, and they're probably all going to be published within the same time span. You may look back and see that no new books on your topic have come out in 4 years. Okay, so now that's an opportunity. The books are out there. They're probably through their usual book life cycle. Now you can come back with something new and hit, you know, the people who bought all of those books the first time around with that. Now, I'm saying that chances are good that your stuff isn't as specialized, but I should really not say it that way. I should say chances are that you're not doing something weird like knitting, design, pattern, writing like me. There's 6,000 designers in the group for designers on Ravelry. 6,000 people is a pretty good market to market to, if you think about it. You can completely tailor it to those 6,000 people, the questions they're asking in that group, the questions that, you know, they're posting online, the things that you see them writing about. And so you're looking at your own 6,000 person focus group. Now, one of our bestsellers this past year came from another subgroup inside that website. It's a type of knitting called double knitting. And the person who wrote the book was the moderator of that entire group. So he not only had the benefit of having an existing relationship with all of these people, but he could say, hey, now my book is coming out. And I'm sure probably all of you are involved in some sort of group or another, some sort of mailing list, something, where you've already got an Instamade focus group to take what it is that you're passionate about and turn that around into a book. So first you're going to look for deficiencies in the market, like what's out there already, what isn't out there. If there is a book out there but they've completely missed the boat or your topic has changed since that book was published, you're going to go and take a look at that first. And again, identifying what books are there but not maybe the greatest, it doesn't take a whole lot to update a topic. I mean, look at the For Dummies books. They're turning those things out, you know, every 5 seconds, every iteration you can think of, people still buy them. And then, you know, what can you add to the conversation once you've taken a look at all of these things? Where do you go from there? Now, I think the biggest stumbling block for people is that they think that they have to start from scratch and they have to have this entirely new, you know, topic that's never been written about before and is completely brand new. And that's not the case, because if you go through your own files on your desktop, if you go through your emails, you could probably pull out enough content to do a reasonably sized ebook about whatever particular topic you're passionate about. And that's why I say the first thing to do is sort of clean your desk, go through your computer. Maybe you've done a report on something. Maybe you have, you know, done a series of blog posts on something. Take your topic and find out what you've already written on it before you go start from scratch again. That's really, I think, one of the fastest ways that you can generate information and content and then see where you need to fill the blanks in rather than starting with a blank page and going from there. So how many of you, just show of hands, who has an iPad? Okay, who has a Kindle? Who has another e-reader? Nook? Yeah. Kobo? No Kobos. Any other device on which you can read ebooks that was not already covered? Android phone. Okay. So we're in the middle of a format war right now, and it hasn't quite resolved itself yet. I'm thinking that EPUB is going to become the defining standard. That's just my personal opinion, but it looks that that's going to be the case. Although Amazon has been steadily resisting that because they want their own format to win out. So basically we've got Amazon versus Apple. That's if you wanted to, you know, put it that way. PDF, you can't go wrong with, because pretty much everyone has a device that can read PDFs. And if you don't really have the technical savvy, which, again, is not a problem I think this group probably has, but if you don't have the technical savvy to produce different formats, you can't go wrong with PDF. PDFs can be sold through online download systems. You know, they're sort of the default format. And again, you can pay specialists to build your ebooks for you. There are websites out there that will build them for you. Some of the skills that you need to have are HTML, because really, when it comes right down to it, a lot of these ebook formats, if you look at them at a code level, are a lot just like a 1997 web page. It's just straight up markup when you break it out that way. InDesign, which is sort of the publishing industry standard, has a function where you can now export straight to EPUB. You're still probably going to have to open it up and do a little bit of tweaking. So the long and the short of it is there's a million and one formats right now. It's finding what your people are using. The reason why I brought the knitting industry into this panel is because we are actually really early adopters of technology when you take a look at it. Knitting patterns can be sold as PDFs or, you know, any other sort of text file. And knitting designers and authors and consumers were using PDFs to trade these, you know, pieces of information long before there were ebooks publicly and readily available. We're talking 10 years ago now. So services like eJunkie, like Payloads, all these digital download services, people were putting up patterns for sale. And the typical knitting pattern retails for about $5. So when Ravelry came around, and that's that Facebook for Knitters site, they added a pattern sales functionality maybe about a year into their existence. Immediately, it went from no sales to over $1 million sales, over $1 million in sales in less than a year. The next year, that number doubled again. It doubled. The number just keeps going up and up and up as the years go by, because a knitter doesn't want to, when you consider the amount of time they spend making something, they don't want to buy a magazine that has 15 patterns and they're not going to knit any of them. They want to buy the pattern that they want. And two, with your audience, whatever it may be, whatever your topic is, they don't want to wade through a For Dummies book that's this thick. They don't want to wade through some, you know, set of books. They want the information they want, and they want it now. This is where you have the advantage, because you can present just that information that they want right now, get it in front of them, and get it sold. Any questions so far? Okay. And again, don't forget the PDFs, because everyone can read PDFs. This, by the way, this last comment is something that my husband said everyone would probably have a little bit of a conniption over. The ebooks aren't quite there yet in terms of layout control. They can be, but again, if you're just getting your feet wet and you're just starting to learn, they can be a little hard. Yeah?
What percentage of the readers actually still read PDFs versus broader?
Versus, in terms of, like, does the Kindle read PDF? Does the...
No, I mean, you don't have e-readers.
Oh. You know what? I haven't seen any solid numbers on that. I know it in my own industry. I know that people will readily buy PDFs in my own industry. I just know that because PDF readers on the desktop and other things like that are free and pretty much everybody can access them, they don't necessarily have to have a device or, you know, Kindle for Mac or anything like that in order to see it, means that at least they can open it. And, you know, counterintuitively, a lot of them will still want to print it off, which is why I say, again, with the PDF format, it's a lot easier to see. So, all right. I think this probably will go over well at a conference like Interactive. Don't. And here's why. If you're going to take that long haul perspective here and the long tail perspective and put something up for sale, you really don't want to be futzing with it, do you? I mean, you want to put it up for sale, and you want it to be available for sale, and you want people to be able to buy it, and you don't want to do tech support on it. That sort of obviates the entire point of doing this. If you're actively managing tech support on something, that's taking away from the time you have to either produce new work or to do whatever else it is that you want to do in your life. So password protecting files or putting DRM on files, it's just asking for it. And it's going to punish your good readers, and it's not going to stop your bad readers. Because I bet if I took a hands up on this one, everyone in this room could break DRM on something if they wanted to try very, very hard. And everyone in this room probably has at some point. MP3s, whatever. So you save yourself the trouble. It's not worth it. You're not losing, you know, $5 million worth of sales to whatever if you put the DRM on it. It's just not worth it. And again, here's a little note for you. eJunkie.com, which is actually the service we use, if you really want to do something DRM-like but not DRM, you can set a setting in there that will print the purchaser's information in the header of each page of the files that they buy. Well, you still have to be able to track it if somebody comes back to you and says, oh, look, I got this for free somewhere. So it just adds a lot of work, I think. So again, sales options. You can do things like eJunkie, like payloads. The Kindle store is 70% royalty rates if you price your work at $9.99 or less. They have a lot of, their royalty rates go all over the place all the time, but that's sort of the hard and fast rule now. Because if you price it over that, you will only get 30%. So Kindle has been incentivizing authors who want to publish through their platform to keep the prices low and to keep the prices competitive. The Apple iBookstore, yeah. $16.95 when we sell direct. When we sell books through Kindle, we put them at $9.99 because it seems silly to not capitalize on that. And if you do the math...
The difference, I'm hearing $7.99 is a good price, or $6.99. You're seeing no difference between those two?
I think it depends on your audience. My audience in particular is trained to think that $5 for a file is a fair price. So for a single pattern... If you give them a book that has 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 patterns, and they're getting that for $15 or $16.95 like we price that, to them, they're doing the math of, oh, that's 15 times 5, and so it seems like a good price to them. If you're in a different field, that may be different. So I think that it's just a question of my audience being trained to think that that is the set price on a file, in the same way that people now think, well, music file downloads should be 99 cents, because early on Apple trained them to think 99 cents was the price. So again, it varies by audience.
But you said you're selling on your site and on Amazon.
I am, yeah. We do direct sales, and what we do is we have... eJunkie is basically an Ajax-based cart that floats on top of your site. And what's nice about it for us is every time we sell a print book, we give away the PDF as well, which is nice for readers, especially readers who are knitters, because a lot of times they'll just want to print off one pattern and take it with them or something like that. So when they order the print copy, we don't charge extra for the PDF. We make the PDF available separately for $16.95, and that's been a boon for our international audience because they don't want to pay $12 to have a book shipped to them. So they'd much rather pay that $16.95, save the shipping, and have it immediately. So what we do is we have eJunkie set up, and people can order, and what'll happen during that checkout process is we get the order for the print book, sure, we get that out, but they also immediately get the download. And it's excellent because you're immediately at the top of their mind. It sends out an email to them telling them where to download it that you can customize. So you can invite them to join your mailing list. You can invite them to, you know, do whatever thing you want them to do next. And that's great. So while we do sell on Amazon, you can't do any of that there. The closest we can do to that, honestly, is when we sell through the Amazon seller account, we have a little rubber stamp that we stamp on the order when we're putting the invoice in that says, oh, thank you for buying from us. You know, here's our mailing list link. Please come, blah, blah, blah. And, yeah.
Would that work for music downloads? Let's say you have a book that also has some music downloads.
Yeah, if it's a digital file. Anything that's a digital file.
And what royalty rates are you getting, or what's the charges for eJunkie?
eJunkie is a monthly paid service, and it depends on the number of files you have up. So it can be anywhere from $5 on up. If they order the print and PDF package, if they order that both, we manually mail them out. I mean,
oh, you do?
Yeah, we do. You could, though. I mean, if this is something that you don't want to fiddle with, and, you know, honestly, yeah, if you're doing a lot of different books, things like that, there are any number of shipment services that you can use, things like ShipWire, even Fulfilled by Amazon. And I'm going to tell you, just having implemented this over the past 3 or 4 months, Amazon seller account, where you're paying about $40 a month to have a pro merchant account on Amazon, I would never have put any of our other books up through the traditional wholesale routes had I known how much more profitable this was going to be in this direction. So I'll give you an example. We have some of our books that get printed print on demand by a company called Lightning Source. Lightning Source is a division of Ingram. Ingram is one of the biggest book distributors in the world. So they basically have these print-on-demand presses running 24/7, and you can get books printed up and to you in a week. I mean, it's really great. For us, we have warehouse space, we have the room to do this, so we'll order copies to have on hand for direct orders. And we could fulfill them all ourselves if we wanted to. But we could also have them printed and shipped directly from Lightning Source. Or we could do fulfillment by Amazon, order a case of books and have them sent straight to Amazon's fulfillment center, and then Amazon pulls from that inventory. You don't even have to touch it. At that point, you know, you're paying them for that privilege. But in terms of the way we're doing it right now, where we're doing our own fulfillment, we end up, by the time you figure in the Amazon shipping credit, which they give you, maybe giving up about $4 or $5 a book. And our print copies retail for $26.95. So $26.95, they tack on $4 for shipping, they take away $5, so it's sort of a big math shuffle around. And what ends up happening is we get $25 in our pocket at the end of the day. So that's very, very close to the retail price, and we have the views of everyone on Amazon coming to us. Amazon has its own publishing service called CreateSpace also. I'm going to tell you, Amazon's CreateSpace is Lightning Source. They are using the exact same printer that I'm using. It's just you're filtering it through an Amazon filter. So one way or another, if you do it that way and you set it up through Lightning Source, you set up an account, you sell through Lightning Source, they will ask you, in order to set up distribution, what percentage off you want to give the, you know, the Amazons and anybody else who wants to buy through their retail distribution system. And the minimum that you have to give them off is, I think, 25% off the top of my head. Now, standard retail discount can be, you know, up to 50 or 60% when you're dealing with other distributors. So even if you set it with 25% off, what ends up happening? Now, how many of you have ever been looking for a book on Amazon? Maybe it's not even in print yet. Maybe it's long out of print. And you will see retailers that claim to have it, and they're charging some crazy amount of money for it. I mean, it happens all the time. So the reason why that happens is they know they can get it through the distributor eventually. So they'll just mark it up, hope some idiot buys it at that price, and then take the time to make the order and get it. And there's got to be some sort of automated software out there for these people, because I don't think they're doing all these listings by hand. So what I've learned from doing the direct Amazon sales is if I pay Lightning Source to print my books, send me a case of the books, and take the time to slip it in an envelope and go, I don't have to give up that 25%. And in fact, I barely have to give up anything, maybe a few dollars. So from my perspective, I'd rather do it that way. You may be different. You may not have the time to do that. So CreateSpace or Fulfillment by Amazon may be a better option. You may be willing to give up that percentage in order to not have to touch it.
So an add-up for tracking of book sales? In other words, going through your own website, Tiny Junkie, do you get book sale credits just like Amazon, just like retail stores?
No. No, it would not count towards Nielsen or any of the book scanning.
New York bestseller and all that stuff.
No. No. And we're in such a specialized audience, too. You know, for us, it's not so big a deal. We're more of a word of mouth when it comes to getting out the word about things. We don't expect to hit the New York Times bestseller list anytime soon. So, I mean, that'd be great, but, you know, let's be realistic here. The top-selling knitting book of all time, I think, currently stands at about 250,000 copies, and that was a publishing fluke that led to every publisher in town buying knitting books for about a space of 3 years, and then going, what do you mean you need an editor? What do you mean you need money to pay things? What do you mean? So they all hop on whatever is the current thing. Debbie Stoller's book Stitch and Bitch comes out, sells 250,000 copies. Suddenly everybody out there wants a knitting book. It's died back down again, but they still think that, well, your book didn't sell 250,000 copies, so it's, you know, there's that strange sense of expectation that the traditional publishers have. And again, they will try to go lowest common denominator. I don't know what all of your fields are, but knitters don't want lowest common denominator. They want to be challenged. They want things that are specialized. The book that we sold the most of last year is a 200-page, densely written, highly technical, frankly slightly crazy book. Elizabeth's read it, she knows, with a page after page after page of photos and how-tos, and honestly, most people who bought that book are never going to knit a thing out of it. I'm just venturing out on a guess here.
It's bragging rights for the show.
Hey, I knitted something out of that. So, but what happened is it made it to Library Journal's Best of 2011 Crafts list, because it was, you know, it caught their attention. And now, every day, I have at least two orders from libraries. The libraries all over the country. And I'm just going to tell you right here and right now, if your book is at all suited to being in libraries, make friends with the libraries. The libraries are going to buy a lot more copies than single users are. And if a librarian loves your book, they're going to actually start doing that job of hand-selling it for you.
Isn't there a list? Because I know there are people who just spend time calling libraries. Is there an
There actually are. I, off the top of my head, can't tell you the website, but I know that there's a database company out there that will sell you the top metropolitan libraries in all of the U.S. and also the top academic libraries for both 2- and 4-year colleges. So that might be something that's worth putting the money into. If I remember correctly, it's not very much. I think it's under $200. And given the amount of money that you can make selling straight to libraries, it would definitely be worth it.
Do you have any bookstore distribution?
We do. And our better audience, though, tends to be the yarn stores. So we sell directly into the yarn stores. We do have things on the shelves. They are orderable. I mean, we're in books and print like everybody else. What'll happen generally is we'll get orders from the specialized distributors who are looking to purchase the books. Honestly, we haven't gone after the Barnes & Nobles of the world. Number one, because they're not making shelf space for indie publishing. They're really not. I mean, and a special subject like mine, something that's specialty, what, they might buy a couple of copies? I mean, it's not really worth me going after them. I had Joanne Fabrics, one of the, you know, Joanne and Hancock Fabrics, one of the larger fabric stores, their distributor approached me. They bought a bunch of books. They're returning half of them. So it's not really the audience. We do better when we target the direct market and when we target the people who want and need our books. So like I said, if you're a member of some sort of specialized group, you know, community, whatever it is that your topic is about, you've got a better chance selling to those people than you do into Barnes & Noble. Yeah?
You were talking about Lightning Source,
mm-hmm.
and and Amazon. So I'm wondering, all things being equal, which would you choose, like the CreateSpace, or would you have your own account? Like,
yeah, knowing that it's the basically the same thing. CreateSpace is essentially Lightning Source Lite for people who don't want to set up a business entity. Now, you know, you never know when you're going to hit it big on a book. I mean, I don't think they knew Stitch and Bitch was going to sell that many copies, right? You're better off, I mean, talk to your accountant, but you're better off being set up for success and having a federal EIN number and having all of the sort of business things. Setting up the account with Lightning Source is not hard. CreateSpace, on the other hand, is a little more user-friendly. It's a little more targeted towards that, you know, audience who maybe would have gravitated to something like Lulu previously. It's essentially, again, a Lulu-type product. If any of you have ever seen Lulu.com or used that, that used to be the big self-publishing, you know, thing.
Also, I read somewhere that on Amazon you're talking about the $9.99, but your book is $16. Is it the same book?
It's the same book. We sell it. We set different prices in different venues.
I read somewhere someone said that Amazon somehow found out they were selling the book for a different price. I mean, I don't know if they're doing research or getting it.
One of the things that they are doing right now, I can tell you, is they're actually incentivizing people to sell at Amazon only. So there's this new Kindle Select program where if you enroll in that, you can only sell digital copies for 90 days there. You can't sell them anywhere else. We're actually looking at this for a book that we have in progress right now. For the first 90 days, you have to specifically restrict the digital copies to Amazon. Now, and I've been back and forth with them because I said, well, look, most of our books are pre-orders. We pre-order and they get the digital and the PDF. Would that interfere with this program in any way? And the basic answer that I've gotten so far is, as long as you're sending out the print copy and not the digital copy before the 90 days are up, as soon as that 90 days are up, we don't really care. I don't think they've got the time or the, you know, frankly, inclination to go after people for that. And I think that you could also argue that because we're including that as a package with some of our other things, it's not the same sort of competition it would be if, say, we priced it at $16.95 on B&N and $9.99 there. So, other questions about pricing? That's, I think, it's one of the harder shoals to navigate, pricing right now. Because all of the, I mean, you can stay on top of what Amazon is doing. They tend to drive the rest of the market. I think that if you're at $9.99 or less, you've got the best shot for selling things. But don't discount putting up a Kindle single or something that's smaller, you know, a 99 cent or a $2 item. I tend to veer away from the 99 cent things myself. I think if they're willing to offer it for that, you know, but I'm also not the typical consumer. Some consumers see a 99 cent book and say, great, I'll take it. They don't even, you know, think twice. They hit buy. Yeah.
What I've had good luck with is pricing it for the for 2 days for free and then bumping it back up. And you get that ripple out from your friends to your friends' friends, but then it goes out further, which is what you want. You want to get strangers to buy.
Exactly. Yeah, so what she's saying, I don't know if you could hear her in the back of the room, is that she'll price it free for the first few days and then bump the price back up,
right,
you know, to whatever.
So we'll get like 500 downloads. And we've hit number one to number four times.
What's your category?
Category business,
self-help. So, and that's a tough nut to crack. That's a tough category to crack. I mean, I, another panel here at South By, I was hearing business books. The New York Times was cutting their number of business book reviews in a year from 24 down to 12, and there are over 100,000 business books being published every year. So if you can get 500 downloads in a, you know, the first few days, and then you're right, that ripple effect spreads out, it's that whole word-of-mouth marketing helping to get you out there. So I'll get back to that in a minute, because one of my big things that I'd like you to take away from this is developing not only your content, but developing where you're going to be putting the word out and where you're going to be selling. Content development is a process. Sales development is a process. And you may have to adjust your prices, as we were just discussing, because, you know, in the terms of the Kindle, you would lower your sales royalty. But less can be more, because look at Amanda Hocking. How many of you have heard of Amanda Hocking? Okay, look how much money she's earned selling, you know, vampire whatever.
Trolls.
I don't want to know. I just don't want to know. So she'll sell the first one for 99 cents, and then the sequels are $2.99 because, you know, people who are readers are a little obsessive, and I think Twilight has, you know, proved that, because if any of you have suffered through all four of those books like I did, then, yeah, they're just terrible. So she'll price the first one low, get everybody hooked, on her characters. Then they come back and they buy the more expensive one. And in the same way that my friend in the fiction world sold that Kindle single, got people into her world, got people into her character's world, now they want to come back and they want to read the other books. So this is one way to market, one way to get things set up so that you're getting the word out, but, you know, still making money. She's selling them for 99 cents. She's not giving them away for free. All right, and so rule three, the, you know, helping people find it. I think branding is important, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be fancy branding. You don't have to, you know, hire a professional graphic designer or whatever. So long as you're consistent and, you know, it looks professional. How many of you have seen typos in your, you know, big publisher books? I mean, come on, the quality control is not exactly there on the higher end. You have control over every single page when you're self-publishing. You know, get somebody else to read it through afterwards. But you have control over every single page. You can make sure that the quality is there. You should also, though, make sure that the look is there. So if somebody buys your first product, they come back and buy a second one, it looks like you. You know, you're using the same fonts. You're using the same layout. You're using the same structure for your work, so long as they're related. And then in terms of availability, like I said, we're still fighting out that format war. So for the time being, you know, there's no one best format, although PDF may be the closest we've got to that. Make it available as many places as you can. And I'm just going to sort of shout out, because BiblioCrunch, are you here? All right, BiblioCrunch is a service we were talking about at O'Reilly's Tools of Change conference the other day. She said she was going to come by. It's a website where if you upload and sell there in their service, they translate it into the different formats for you. BiblioCrunch. So there's that. There's Smashwords. There's a lot of different digital marketplaces where, depending on what your particular genre or your particular subject matter is, you may actually be better off in one of the smaller, more specialized sales markets than getting it on Amazon. Obviously, you want to put it on Amazon, but you might actually end up doing better having it in that specialized market. In the same way that for every, you know, sale that we make on Amazon, we're making 15 sales over, you know, in Ravelry. So it's about knowing where your people are. And then, again, staying in touch, MailChimp, other mailing list software. You want to give people a reason to give you their information. You know, whether you can incentivize things that way. You could give the, you know, a free taste of your next book if somebody mails, you know, gets on the mailing list. Any number of ways that you can incentivize things. But once you've got them on your mailing list and you're not spamming them and you're being a good, you know, email citizen, next time your next book comes out, that 500 people you netted by dropping the price on the first book are already there and in position to hear about your second book that's coming out. What we do at our company is when we bring out a new book that's related to a previous book, so say a sock knitting book, and we already have another sock knitting book that came out 6 months earlier, we're going to mail everybody who bought the earlier book and say, hi, you know, we have a new book. It's also socks and, you know, yo, dog, I heard you like socks, so let's give you some socks in your socks. And everybody will turn around and buy it. Or if not everybody, a good enough percentage to make the time of spent sending that email worthwhile. Again, flexibility. Because if we're still settling the format debate, you know, there's no one true answer. There's no one true thing. Making sure that it's available on every platform, if that's not your thing, if you don't have the time to, you know, spend translating books into different formats, getting them out onto every, you know, different device and platform and this and that and the other, and you don't want to hire somebody to do it, then again, pick one and stick with it and make sure that people know that's where to find you. Say you're selling on Smashwords, say you're selling on one of the other ebook sites. Put that in your email footer. Get people to know where they can find you. Because if they can't find you, they can't buy it. I'm going to introduce my assistant Elizabeth here, who is a genius and who netted this few $100 listed on the screen for me. A new pattern sales site came out, and I personally did not have the time to go putting up my patterns on this new site. I wouldn't have done it. It would have gotten done 6 months from now. She said, you know, we should maybe put the patterns up there. Fine, great, go for it. And in a week, there's $200 I didn't have before. These are things that weren't even new. These are things that have been out for 4 and 5 years. But because it was new to that audience, they'd never seen it before, boom, a bunch of money came in. And now, because one of those patterns has sold enough copies to make it into the top 10 list on that site, now every time people who click onto that site see the top 10 list, there it is, now more people are buying it. So in that same ripple effect that we're talking about earlier, the more people see it, the more people buy it, the higher it goes up, the more people see it, the more people buy it. You know, if you're in that self-help category on Amazon, how many people do you think go through and just go to the category and look and see, well, I'm looking for a self-help book, what's out there? I'm looking for a knitting book, what's out there? If you can get yourself up into the rankings in a more specialized category or on a more specialized site, it's going to be a lot easier for people to find you. Questions? Okay. And again, actively promoting. If you don't promote, people are not going to find you. Honestly, the number of emails I send in a day, I think probably my email footer is the best, you know, possible way to get the word out about things. I tell people where my mailing list is and where they can buy our products. And if you figure that I'm sending on average 100 emails a day, maybe, you know, 40% of those people have not communicated with me before, I'm getting the possibility of 40 new people coming over and checking that out. If you encourage your fans to share it with people that they like, you give them some sort of an incentive, like a free pattern or some other sort of, you know, clip or teaser, or maybe a sample chapter the way Amazon does when you shop for something on the Kindle store, you know, that's also going to drive people to you.
Do you do any podcasts and stuff?
I have in the past. I haven't recently. The knitting world's actually pretty rife with podcasts, so what my personal focus has been getting my authors onto other people's podcasts rather than podcasting myself. It's just, I mean, from my perspective as the publisher and not just an author. If I was an author, though, I would be trying to get myself on every single one of them. And I am an author, but that's not my primary focus right now. So what I do is I make sure that all the top podcasts in my specific field, I know who those people are, I know what sort of bookings they're doing, I have a general idea of what topics they cover, because it varies, and I'm constantly sending them, you know, review copies, free copies. Hi, we have a new book out. Here's a copy, and by the way, the author's available. Do you want her on the podcast? Most of the knitting podcasters, honestly, you know, they're stay-at-home moms. They're, you know, they do this for fun. So for them, it's super exciting to get a free review copy. It's super exciting to have the author on. And most of the time, they jump at the chance. Depending what your specialty is, that may be completely different. But at least in our world, it's very easy to book people onto things like podcasts and even TV shows and radio shows. It's just, it's its own specialized thing. This is, again, the book I was talking about earlier, that the book that made it to the top was the specialized one, and it hit Library Journal. We really need to be nice to the librarians. The librarians are going to order a lot of books from you if you do this. All right, so Ronco, right? Set it and forget it. Once you've got the formats out there, once you've got things up for sale, honestly, tracking the sales numbers is one of those what we call kitten busy in my studio. You pretend like you're busy, but you're not really busy. You're checking Facebook. You're doing all these other things. Put it out there. Let it be out there. Do the promotional work that needs to be done, and then move on to the next thing. Because really, at the heart of the long tail, it's getting more stuff out there and building more over time and letting all that money dribble in smaller amounts rather than relying on one big Oprah moment to net some huge amount of money. Now, 10 Speed Press, who's one of my former publishers, they used to actually send out a packet that essentially said in about a stack this thick, you're not getting on Oprah. Forget it. It's not happening. Okay, now here's what you can do. And so you need to sort of reset your expectations. You may not get on the New York Times, whatever, but can you get into the local paper? Probably. Can you get onto the local radio station? Probably. And all of that upper level media feeds up, percolates up from the bottom. I did an interview with the local newspaper last week. It's the tiny community newspaper. Did I really have the time to spare? No, but I know that the bigger regional newspaper keeps an eye out for stories there. So it's worth my time to do it. If you set everything up in such a way that you're constantly working on new material, you're constantly pulling through, you know, ideas and seeing what you can build out of them, it's going to take off. And it's going to take off when you least expect it, because again, we never know what book is going to be the hit, right? I mean, how many books over the past 5 years did you look at and go, wow, how did that make the top 10 list? How did that make the top? You never know what's going to hit. So if you keep going and you keep producing more content, and again, you're not now working to a publisher's schedule. It isn't I turn in my manuscript and 3 months later my editor gives it back edited, and then 6 months later maybe it gets printed, and then it hits the shelves a year later. So because you're in control of that time cycle, honestly, once you're done with the work and you've, you know, gotten the word out about it, you're better off going back and working on the next thing rather than obsessing over the first thing. So if there's one thing that I can say, it's make sure that you're getting a constant stream of things. That's what's going to bring in the money over the long haul, is having more pieces. And as your audience builds and people are buying everything that you put out, or starting to buy everything that you put out, maybe you had 500 customers before and now you have 750. Now they're buying the new one. Now you have 1,000 and they're buying the new one. It builds over time. And I think that's really what the heart of the long tail is when it comes to self-publishing, is making sure you've got the materials out there and that they're ready and available to sell.
Are you a publisher, a hybrid publisher, or
a book coach, or author? You know, I have many things. I am an author and I am a publisher. The way that we're structured is such that we have editorial control. So we're not a vanity press. We're not just taking anything in the door and putting it out there. We're exercising editorial control. But we are structured in such a way that the authors actually make more money working with us because we don't pay advances. My thinking on that is if you want to do this book enough, you're going to do it without me or with me. And honestly, I've seen the way advances work in my own publishing career as an author. I don't think they incentivize people to do their best work. What incentivizes people to do their best work is getting the control to put out the product that they want. That's why I turned that $15,000 down from Random House. I didn't want to do that book. When it really came down to brass tacks, I did not want to do the book they wanted us to do. And every time we came back with a different contract negotiation and they added a new twist and, oh, now we want this and now we want that, it had moved away from the book I wanted to do to a book I had no interest in whatsoever. So by giving them that creative control, they are then able to not only do their best work, but to be heavily invested in the work. And when that's the case, honestly, you do so much better. We had an author last year, her book was released towards the beginning of the year, so she's a good example of a full year cycle. I want to say she made $11,000 last year, which would be a respectable advance from a craft publisher these days. But she was getting paid every 2 months. She had full control over what went into that book and what didn't. I was there to serve as the editor. I was there to coordinate photo shoots. I was there to do all the editorial work for her. She put out the book she wanted. She put out the book she wanted. I put out the book I wanted. And she ended up netting as much or more as she would have gotten from another publisher, plus the added benefit of getting paid every 2 months, which in the traditional publishing world, you're typically paid every six. So how do you live on that? And you don't even know. You don't even know what money is coming in next. At least you can call me up and say, hey, what's my next check going to be? I need, you know, to know. Although Random House today just announced to authors that they're building an author portal that will let you check on your own royalty statements. It's 2012. Why we couldn't have had this 5 years ago, I don't know. Because it's usually you're waiting every 6 months and then, oh, surprise, you made nothing. Oh, surprise, here's $100. Thank you. So, yeah, I'll tell you number-wise, flat out number-wise, and my accountant told me this and I didn't believe her. We did over six figures in sales last year. We did not net over six figures last year because our print costs are considerably higher than, say, a traditional publisher, not only because we do smaller runs, but because we print in the U.S. and not in China. So right there, that affects the print cost. I'll give you numbers. I think we grossed about 172, And of all the expenses that we were just going through for taxes, I want to say we paid out $30,000 in print charges alone. So right there, that's a pretty significant chunk. But the actual structure of the business is such that when we sell a print copy of a book, we subtract the cost of printing the book. What's left over is 50-50 with the author. And in terms of the digital, because the digital is there once the print's done, you know, once it's there, we 60-40 it in their favor. So if the digital keeps selling, which we've seen is the case, what'll happen is you'll have the print goes up at the beginning, great, with a little bit of extra digital, and then over time the print slopes back down again and the digital just keeps going up. More people learn about the book, more people, you know, buy it. It just keeps going up and up and up. And because at some point we may not have to print the book anymore, there may be no demand for the print, great, you know, then it's pure profit. So, yes.
I'm going to use the microphone since I'm losing my voice.
Oh, no.
I have a two-part question.
Sure.
I'm a fiction writer, and I'm working on a collection of short stories about women and their tattoos. So you talked about, like, being in yarn stores as, like, your tertiary direct market.
Sure.
Should I be talking to, like, the tattoo parlors that some of these stories are set in?
Absolutely.
And being like, hey, I'm featuring your parlor in a book. Can I put it in your tattoo parlor?
Absolutely. And anytime you have a specialized market where the market itself has a market, like a specific type of retail or something like that, like yarn stores are for us, absolutely. I mean, now's the time to start going to the tattoo conventions and saying, hey, we have this book coming out, and, you know, is this something you might like to do? You could even solicit pre-orders.
I just wondered, because, like, it's fiction. It's not, like, about tattoos themselves. Mm-hmm. Like it's about the stories behind them. But do you think that that's something that I should be doing?
Well, yeah. And, okay. Well, I know just from personal experience, there's a book out called Tattoo Machine by a guy called Jeff Johnson, who actually did my first and currently only tattoo, which is an editing term that I have in typewriter font. He did an entire storybook of just stories from his 20-plus years in the tattoo business. It sold like crazy. I think it did hit the New York Times list at some point or another. There are a lot of people in America with tattoos right now. There's a market. And because you've already got an established set of shops that are right there to, you know, take that book from you, sure, go get a professional directory of some kind. Start selling direct into there, seeing if any of them want to buy it. Because you know what? Honestly, if you can do a larger print run up front, if you're going to do it in print, it's going to decrease your costs over the long run. So you're better off soliciting up front. Yeah.
Regarding that point, like we just saw at a speaker, Peter Diamantis, mm-hmm. He wrote a book called Abundance. And he had this ex company. They wanted to do the space, the private space travel. He created a company. Now he's got like the chairman of Google on his board. It's pretty high level hitter. He had this book called Abundance coming out. So he did a bunch of speeches, and you went on his website and bought the pre-sale.
Exactly.
And
which is what we do. I mean, we do the pre-sale, and generally the pre-sales will fund not only the expenses of the book, such as hiring a photographer or any of the other expenses that we have, but it will also generally fund the entire first print run of that book.
Right, and he did, I don't know, 6 months worth of speeches, and when the funding went national, it was on the bestseller list because mm-hmm. he built up a lot of pre-sales.
Yeah, absolutely. Hank Green, anybody know Vlogbrothers, the website? They're these two guys. They have a video podcast, and they're sort of nerdy, sciencey, geeky guys. They're really funny. Well, the one is actually also a teen novelist. He writes sort of, you know, that age range novels. And so he was, before that book was even out, he was pumping it up, saying he would send out a signed book plate or saying he would, you know, do all of these things. When that thing finally did hit, right up into number one of its category on Amazon, and it stayed there. Now, he had a big publisher behind him, but they weren't the ones doing that promotion. So even if you do a book with a big publisher, you can still use the principles that we were talking about in order to drive sales, in order to, and you may not have direct control over, you know, the actual distribution or being able to send out ebooks or anything like that, But you do have control over the promotion, over building up the audience, and going from there. And I'm seeing right now a lot of people who had traditional book deals are turning around and for their second, third, fourth books, doing it themselves because they see the amount of money they make for all the work they put in, and they think, you know, I might get less at the beginning, but over time I'll make the same amount. I'd rather do it this way. Yeah.
When that example you gave us in the beginning with that one publisher, when was that?
That was 3 or 4 years ago, I want to say.
And also you wrote on there, no billings but royalties. Why is that?
In the case of our particular genre and what I'm told from people in other genres, anymore the amount of total copies of books sold for a given book, by the time you calculate the what you've been given up front, the way the publisher math works is that you get an advance and you have to, quote, earn out. And earn out just means that if, and making the math number easy, say you got $10,000 up front and you expect to net a dollar per copy on every book sold, you have to sell 10,000 books before you ever see another penny over that. And it's a lot more complex than that because of what I call publisher math. But in essence, that means you have to sell that many before you're ever going to see another penny. And then you're only ever going to see that other penny 6 months from now. So in essence, what happens is most books don't earn out. At least in my field, it may be different in some other fields. But in the sort of mid-list and smaller niche genres, most books aren't earning out anymore. And I'm actually told that 15,000 copies in a craft book sale is pretty respectable. 10,000 would be considered okay. So if you figure you got paid 10,000 and you need to net, oh, okay, you're already in the minus. So that's why I say don't expect royalties. And in fact, most people I know have started just negotiating for the highest possible advance they can get up front, knowing that they're probably not going to earn out. Yeah.
What's the benefit of doing a print run versus...
Well, it's best if you can sort of hybrid it, like Lightning Source, where you could do a full print run or you could do, you know, this many at a time. So say most of the time you don't go out on the road and talk about your book or go to conferences or things like that. You're not sitting on 2,000 copies in your garage. You can print out, you know, 100, take them to the show, go from there. If you do a print run, it's generally to drive down the price per book, but that's really more for full color type things like we do in the craft world. If you're doing a black and white book, honestly, it almost works out the same. It's really about, do you want to front the money for 400 copies or for 4,000 copies, and it's just a math question at that point. One of my personal books that we publish is a black and white book, and costs us about $350 per to print them on demand. And honestly, rather than sitting on a case of, you know, 1,000, I'd rather just do them as we need them. Yeah.
Have you experimented with Pinterest at all?
We have. In fact, we were in Crane's business for last week. They wanted to know how businesses were in our area were using Pinterest. And what we've done... Actually, hey, wait, we have technology on our side. I'll put this back up in a second. Let me show you. Here, I'll show it on our site. We put a pin up. We put a pin it button on each page for each book. So... we're in the process of redoing our site. But so here we've got the pin it button. You can see that this book, which came out fairly recently, has already been pinned 26 times. That means 26 people and all those 26 people's friends and all their friends are now looking at it. So by making it easy for people to do and saying, hey, this is something you can do, people who might not have thought to do that will do it. From a business perspective, because I'm a fairly well-known name in the knitting industry, a lot of people follow me on Pinterest, follow my personal Pinterest account. So what I did is do an entire board of nothing but Cooperative Press books. So now the people who come to me because they're coming to me can also see my product. And it's not an obnoxious way. I'm not spamming anybody with it. It's just, look, here's our books. Here's what I do most of the time. Here's an opportunity for you to repin it. And what'll happen when you pin it, it's probably going to fail because, of course, we're not logged in. Okay. But you know how Pinterest works. What we're going to start doing with our marketing books and our books that are not sort of more visually based is taking choice quotes from those books, making a very pretty Pinteresty, you know, typographically pretty pin, and getting people to pin that. Then if the quote intrigues them, they want to come and seek out the book. So, and I think, are we at time? Yes, we are. So yeah, let me know if you need anything, any other questions. I'll have my cards up here if anybody wants to get in touch after, but thank you very much.